Welcome. This is the New England Journal of Medicine. I'm Dr. Michael Bierer. This week, September 25th, 2025, we talk about heart failure, provoked venous thromboembolism, chronic lymphocytic leukemia, and acute ischemic stroke. A review article on medical education to improve diagnostic equity. A case report of a man with embolic stroke and left ventricular apical aneurysm. Two articles on the 2025 Lasker-DeBakey Clinical Medical Research Award. And perspectives on structural and scientific racism, on the Gates Foundation's final chapter, and on Dr. Kohlhaas and the cowboy. Digitoxin in Patients with Heart Failure and Reduced Ejection Fraction by Udo Bavendieck from Hanover Medical School, Hanover, Germany, and co-authors. Cardiac glycosides have been used in the treatment of heart failure for two centuries. However, evidence of benefit in patients with heart failure and reduced ejection fraction is limited. In this trial, 1,212 patients with chronic heart failure who had a left ventricular ejection fraction of 40% or less and a New York Heart Association NYHA functional class of 3 or 4, or a left ventricular ejection fraction of 30% or less and an NYHA functional class of 2, were randomly assigned to receive the cardiac glycoside digitoxin or matching placebo in addition to guideline-directed medical therapy. Treatment with digitoxin led to a lower combined risk of death from any cause or hospital admission for worsening heart failure than placebo among patients with heart failure and reduced ejection fraction who received guideline-directed medical therapy. At least one serious adverse event occurred in 4.7% of patients in the digitoxin group and in 2.8% of those in the placebo group. Mark Pfeffer of the Mass General Brigham Heart and Vascular Institute, Boston, writes in an editorial that the trial by Bavendieck and co-authors should be viewed against the backdrop of the diminished use of digoxin. The decline in the use of digoxin was doubtless multifactorial. The compelling evidence that beta blockers prolonged survival, in contrast with the excess mortality noted with newer inotropic agents, reduced enthusiasm for cardiac glycosides. Digitoxin, which was used in the study by Bavendieck and co-authors, is a less studied, non-FDA-approved cardiac glycoside. In that trial, the incidence of primary outcome events, death from any cause, or hospitalization for worsening heart failure, whichever occurred first, was lower in the digitoxin group than in the placebo group. But the trial faced recruitment challenges, and the reduced sample size inevitably limited the reliability and conclusiveness of the findings. But the trial offers clinicians an important reminder of the existing opportunities with the approved cardiac glycoside, digoxin. At present, the judicious use of digoxin to reduce the incidence of complications related to heart failure with reduced ejection fraction in carefully selected patients is an available and important option for physicians and patients. Apixaban for extended treatment of provoked venous thromboembolism by Gregory Piazza from Brigham and Women's Hospital, Harvard Medical School, Boston, and co-authors. Venous thromboembolism, VTE, has traditionally been categorized as provoked, occurring after such transient risk factors as surgery, trauma, or immobility, or unprovoked, occurring without a readily identifiable trigger. Extended duration anticoagulation is commonly prescribed for patients with unprovoked VTE because of a high risk of recurrence, 6 to 10% per year, after the discontinuation of anticoagulation. For patients with provoked VTE who do not have either cancer or severe thrombophilia, the recurrence risk is lower. In such patients, guidelines typically recommend 3 months of anticoagulation. In this study, 600 adults with VTE after the occurrence of a transient provoking factor who had at least one enduring risk factor and had completed at least 3 months of anticoagulation were assigned to receive oral apixaban at a dose of 2.5 milligrams twice daily or placebo for 12 months. The trial population had a broad range of provoking factors and enduring risk factors. Among these patients, low-intensity therapy with apixaban for 12 months resulted in a lower risk of symptomatic recurrent VTE than placebo, with a low risk of major bleeding. Editorialist Neil Zakai from the University of Vermont, Burlington, writes that the finding of this trial by Piazza and co-authors underline the importance of individualized decision-making regarding the use of anticoagulation after provoked VTE, particularly in patients with persistent risk factors for VTE. It also exposes the limits of our current VTE categories. The overall terms of provoked or unprovoked are too blunt to guide care because they group together patients with hugely different recurrence risks. Thus, we need to develop and validate models that integrate baseline risk factors, features of the acute event, bleeding risk, patient values, and clinician experience to determine who may benefit from extended VTE prevention. Above all, we need clear, standardized definitions of triggering factors so that patients with similar risks are grouped and treated consistently. Extended anticoagulation can offer substantial benefit to selected patients with provoked VTE, but only if we are able to identify them accurately. Future prevention strategies should blend scientific evidence, clinician judgment, and patient values. The goal is not simply to decide whether to extend therapy, but to know for whom the benefits outweigh the risks, and how patients and treating clinicians weigh those benefits and risks. The provoked label should not end the conversation regarding the duration of anticoagulation. It should be the opening to an individualized, patient-centered conversation. Measurable residual disease-guided therapy for chronic lymphocytic leukemia by Talha Munir from the Leeds Cancer Center, United Kingdom, and co-authors. In this Phase 3 trial, patients with chronic lymphocytic leukemia, CLL, were randomly assigned to receive the oral BTK inhibitor ibrutinib combined with the oral small molecule inhibitor of BCL2, venetoclax, or ibrutinib alone, or the chemoimmunotherapy regimen of fludarabine cyclophosphamide rituximab, FCR. An interim analysis of progression-free survival in this trial showed that ibrutinib venetoclax was superior to FCR among the patients with CLL. Now the investigators present the results of a planned analysis comparing measurable residual disease, MRD-guided ibrutinib venetoclax with ibrutinib alone and FCR with extended follow-up. With extended follow-up and increased enrollment, the trial showed that undetectable MRD and extended progression-free survival occurred more often with ibrutinib venetoclax than with ibrutinib alone or FCR. The results for overall survival were also consistent with a benefit of ibrutinib venetoclax. Early tirofiban infusion after intravenous thrombolysis for stroke by Chunrong Tao from the University of Science and Technology of China, Hefei, and co-authors. Acute ischemic stroke is the leading cause of death in China and among the leading causes of death worldwide. Intravenous thrombolysis within 4.5 hours after onset remains a standard treatment for acute ischemic stroke. Vascular reocclusion may occur after intravenous thrombolysis and may be preventable with the addition of an antiplatelet agent within the first 24 hours after thrombolysis. Tirofiban, a platelet glycoprotein 2B3A receptor antagonist, has reduced macrovascular reocclusion in experimental models. In this Phase 3 trial conducted at 38 centers in China, 432 patients with acute ischemic non-cardioembolic stroke who presented within 4.5 hours after stroke onset and who were not eligible for thrombectomy were randomly assigned to receive a 24-hour intravenous infusion of tirofiban or placebo within 60 minutes after intravenous thrombolysis. In these patients, early tirofiban increased the likelihood of an excellent functional outcome. The incidence of intracranial hemorrhage was low, but higher with tirofiban than placebo. Advancing diagnostic excellence with medical education in diagnostic equity. A review article by Denise Connor from the University of California, San Francisco, and co-authors. Diagnostic error, a long-standing quality and safety problem now receiving increasing recognition, encompasses the spectrum of mistakes and inappropriate delays in identifying and communicating accurate diagnoses. Diagnostic errors are often hidden and challenging to measure. However, researchers are now successfully doing just that. Until recently, studies addressing diagnostic error largely overlooked ways in which interpersonal and systemic racism and other forms of oppression, such as ableism and sexism, may contribute to such errors. A growing literature regarding inequities in diagnosis, disparities in occurrences of diagnostic error that disproportionately affect persons in relation to their social identities, is raising awareness about this previously obscured issue. In parallel with increased attention to diagnostic error, medical education has also increased its focus on health equity. In this article, the authors review how attending to the intersection of clinical reasoning education and health equity education, centering on the emerging concept of diagnostic equity, can support diagnostic excellence. The authors present strategies drawn from the literature on diagnostic reasoning, health equity, implicit bias, structural competency, and healthcare communication to guide clinician educators and educational programs in supporting equity in the diagnostic process. A 53-year-old man with embolic stroke and left ventricular apical aneurysm. A case record of the Massachusetts General Hospital by Garrick Stewart and colleagues. A 53-year-old man presented with acute multifocal stroke affecting the left middle cerebral artery, resulting in right-sided weakness and expressive aphasia. His symptoms had followed several days of abdominal discomfort and an episode of coffee ground emesis. Evaluation revealed a dilated left ventricle with severe systolic dysfunction and an apical aneurysm, though no obstructive coronary disease or intracardiac shunt was identified. Over several months, despite guideline-directed medical therapy, his left ventricular ejection fraction remained reduced, and cardiac MRI showed extensive fibrosis with apical dyskinesis. Given his emigration from Central America, where Trypanosoma cruzi infection is endemic, and the characteristic findings of ventricular dilation, apical aneurysm, and embolic stroke, serologic testing was performed. Two distinct antibody assays were positive, confirming the diagnosis of chronic Chagas cardiomyopathy. Transformative Research in Cystic Fibrosis, A Clinical Implications of Basic Research by Eric Sorscher from Emory University School of Medicine, Atlanta. In 1938, physician-scientist Dorothy Anderson first described cystic fibrosis, a lethal disease in infants and children characterized by pancreatic fibrosis with cyst formation and bronchiectasis, including thick, inspissated secretions that obstruct the airways. Cystic fibrosis has subsequently been classified as a generalized exocrinopathy involving numerous additional epithelial tissues, such as liver, intestines, reproductive tract, and sweat glands. During the ensuing decades, palliative treatments became standard care and prolonged lives, but the pathogenic mechanism remained a mystery. The identification in 1989 of the causal gene CFTR, which encodes the cystic fibrosis transmembrane conductance regulator, CFTR, was a milestone, although whether the breakthrough would result in better treatments was unclear. Over time, Michael Welsh, Jesus Gonzalez, and Paul Negulescu would elucidate the pathogenesis, advance pharmaceutical science in remarkable new directions, and provide a transformational therapy for the disease. Their achievements are recognized by the 2025 Lasker-DeBakey Clinical Medical Research Award. The recorded life expectancy of a person with cystic fibrosis was generally months to a few years when Dorothy Anderson first described the disease. Today, the projected median age of survival for persons with cystic fibrosis who were born between 2020 and 2024 and have access to treatment is 65 years. Surprisingly complex assemblies from low-complexity domains, a clinical implications of basic research article by Tanya Mittag from St. Jude Children's Research Hospital, Memphis, Tennessee. Low-complexity domains in proteins are composed of a small subset of the full complement of amino acids, and in these domains, the amino acid sequences are often repetitive. Their relevance to health and disease is underscored by the 2025 Albert Lasker Award for Basic Medical Research, given to Dirk Gerlich and Stephen McKnight for showing that low-complexity domains lack structure and yet can form into assembled states that mediate critical functions in cells. The combined work of Gerlich and McKnight on low-complexity domains indicates the plastic and manifold abilities of these protein domains. Moreover, the insights of Gerlich, McKnight, and their colleagues are being harnessed in medical research, for example, in the context of neurodegenerative disease, possibly charting a course toward therapies aimed at slowing or curing neurodegenerative disease. In another example, the realization that self-assembly by low-complexity domains can drive the formation of signaling condensates may solve an urgent problem in heart transplantation medicine that may improve donor heart quality. Structural and scientific racism, science and health. Evidence versus ideology. A perspective by Nancy Krieger and Mary Bassett, from the Harvard T.H. Chan School of Public Health, Boston. Despite decades of rigorous work documenting the harmful effects of structural racism on health, healthcare, and scientific knowledge and research, the current executive branch of the U.S. government and its political appointees have deemed work on structural racism and health to be ideological and, quote, not scientific. Consequently, the government has terminated National Institutes of Health and other federal grants, funding work it considers to be focused on DEI, or diversity, equity, and inclusion. These moves conflate research on health equity with work that aims to change the composition and climate of the scientific workforce and institutions. Opposition to these government actions now extends from the scientific community to the legal arena, with a federal judge ruling on June 16th that the grant terminations are discriminatory and illegal. The contradictory stances of current NIH leaders on one side and a broader scientific community and the district court on the other aren't merely a matter of opinion or, quote, viewpoint diversity. The difference is evidence. Only the latter position is informed by high-quality research conducted over the course of a generation. As the district court recently made clear, the refusal of the executive branch of the U.S. government and its political appointees to engage with the substantive evidence about and to fund research on the harmful effects of racism on health is itself a form of racial discrimination. From health to wealth, reframing global aid through the Gates Foundation's final chapter, a perspective by Stephen Phillips from the COVID Collaborative, Washington, D.C. Bill Gates announced in May 2025 that the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation would disperse $200 billion by 2045, culminating in the closure of the institution. This sunset clause, uncommon in big philanthropy, comes at a moment of major uncertainty for global health finance. In 2024, global health aid, part of official development assistance, which is the international flow of government aid from high-income countries, experienced its steepest decline in a generation, making a potential inflection point for international development funding. Since its launch in 2000, the foundation has distributed approximately $62 billion in global health grants. In his 2014 annual letter, Gates speculated that, quote, By 2035, there will be almost no poor countries left in the world. His prediction was attributed to innovation in vaccines, digital tools, improved education, and global partnerships. The substantial health benefits of the health-to-wealth transformation of the past quarter century are well documented. But with regard to broader development outcomes, the picture is more complicated. The disparate results make clear that even when health improves, deeper economic shifts don't always follow. Now the Foundation's core proposition, that health begets wealth, must contend with the mixed macroeconomic evidence. Dr. Kohlhaas and the Cowboy, a perspective by Mark Ernest from the University of Colorado Anschutz Medical Campus, Aurora. He's a real cowboy. I mean the bona fide real thing, Dr. Kohlhaas told them. It was Dr. Ernest's first day on the oncology ward as an intern, and Dr. Kohlhaas, his attending, was telling them about the patients they were about to meet. This guy has probably spent more nights sleeping under the stars than under a roof. I'm not sure he'd ever seen a doctor before he was diagnosed, Dr. Kohlhaas went on. Just imagine that. You see a doctor for the first time and he tells you you have a cancer on your penis. The cancer was advanced when it was diagnosed and had since spread widely. This chemo regimen was the cowboy's last option. It might buy him some more months, Dr. Kohlhaas explained, but it would not be curative. Toward the end of the week, Dr. Kohlhaas threw out a new detail about the cowboy. Did you know that he's never been to the National Western? He asked. He's lived his whole life less than 100 miles from here, and he's never been, not once. Dr. Kohlhaas explained that for nearly a century, Denver had hosted the National Western Stock Show. For 2 weeks every January, ranchers and cowboys from throughout the country would bring their prize livestock to Denver for show and auction and to watch the world's best rodeo riders compete. Opening day was the next day, and it was a really big deal. The next morning, the cowboy was fully dressed when Dr. Ernest knocked on his door. Wranglers, boots, Western shirt. What's happening? Dr. Ernest asked, knowing he had several more days of chemo scheduled. I'm going to the stock show, he said flatly. He reached into his breast pocket, fished out two items, and held them out for Dr. Ernest to see. One was a ticket to the National Western Stock Show. The other was a crisp $100 bill. That doctor came in this morning and gave these to me. He said there'd be a cab out front to take me over there. I gotta get moving. In our Images in Clinical Medicine, a 65-year-old man presented with a 4-month history of a rash and a 2-month history of diarrhea and weight loss. Examination showed a maculopapular eruption. CT revealed osteosclerosis of thoracic vertebral bodies, a diagnosis of systemic mastocytosis, a condition characterized by mast cell infiltration of organs such as the bone marrow, liver, gastrointestinal tract, and cortical bone, was made. Another image shows doxycycline-induced phototoxicity. A 15-year-old girl presented with a 2-week history of a painful, blistering rash on both hands. 1 week before the onset of symptoms, she had started oral doxycycline therapy to treat acne. Read more from our issue at nejm.org. Let us know what you think about our podcast. Any comments or suggestions may be sent to audio@nejm.org. Thank you for listening.